Right, okay, so good morning everybody, and thank you all for coming back. So this is the second of the three lectures on Buddhist physicalism. And so we had the general introduction, some of the main problems yesterday, and so this is going to be the second part, or the third part this afternoon, and I think in the second lecture Mark is going to talk about some more specific problems, in particular about the notion, I think, of substantial consciousness or not in Buddhist physicalism. Is that what you're doing? Yeah. Okay, well, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming on a grey, cold morning. Oh, this is a different keyboard. Okay, so those of you who were not here yesterday, the project is to see if it's possible to develop a physicalist form of Buddhist philosophy. The classical Indian Buddhist schools were all anti-physicalist. They rejected the Charvaka view in particular, which was the one classical Indian school that did espouse physicalism. So the Buddhists are, in fact, anti-physicalists. What I'm interested in is whether it's possible to quote-unquote naturalize Buddhism in a modern culture that for which the natural sciences give us the best shot at understanding the nature of reality. And consequently have to say something in response to Buddhist anti-physicalism. Now, one of the things we talked about yesterday was the basic parameters of Buddhist metaphysical scruples. What exactly a Buddhist will claim is, are the ingredients of the world as it is in itself, independently of our cognitive limitations and our interests. We superimpose all sorts of stuff on reality that isn't actually there. We only think it's there because it's useful for us to understand the world in that way. What then does count as what's ultimately real? Where's the
clicker?
Do you have the clicker?
The clicker is here.
Oh, yeah. It's hiding. They do all hold that consciousness is ultimately real, by which is meant something that exists independently of the concepts that we happen to employ. And they hold that consciousness is a dharma, something that's ultimately real. And there are two different kinds of what I'm calling internal world realism in the classical Indian Buddhist literature. There's a dualism that is espoused by Vaibhashika and Theravada that allows for four of the five skandhas, the aggregates of psychophysical elements making up a person. Vedana, Samnya, Sanskaras, and Vijnana are all non-physical dharmas. So Tarantika collapses those four nama dharmas into one. It's basically all Vijnana. They don't distinguish between Chitta and Chaita dharmas, those of you who know this stuff. And then there's Yogacara, which says that there's really just one kind of ultimately real entity, Vijnana. Consciousness, or cognition. They all agree that dharmas are momentary. They only last an instant, and they immediately go out of existence, but cause other dharmas to come into existence if things are more or less the same in the environment. What come into existence are just like the things that just went out of existence. And so there is what appears to be continuity in the macrophysical objects that we experience in the world. There also appears to be continuity in what we think of as ourselves, our persons. our bodies and our minds, our consciousnesses. And the continued existence of a person just consists, it is nothing more than these physical and mental dharmas, or for Yogacara, these mental dharmas, existing for a moment and then going out of existence but causing successors. It's a causal series of impermanent, impersonal, radically impermanent, momentary dharmas arranged in the way that we conceptualize as a person. Now, why do they reject physicalism? Well, talked at some length yesterday about how much of this is motivated by the fact that physicalism makes the karma rebirth ideology extremely implausible. It's not necessarily ruled out, but it seems highly unlikely, particularly when we think of physics or the natural world in general as we understand it today. In fact, the charge of physicalism tended to function in the classical Indian world just like the charge of atheism has in the West up until fairly recently. Oh, you're an atheist, you don't believe in God, that must mean you engage in all sorts of immoral, illegal, messy, bad conduct. Because the karma rebirth ideology is thought to give people reason to not act, well, act in ways that will lead to a bad rebirth. But there's also part of the anti-physicalism and stuff comes out of the fact that as they see it, as these possibly Buddhists saw it, karmic seeds being mental entities, not physical entities, can act at a distance. And so that can account for the fact that I die here and then I am reborn. That is, a new set of skandhas, a new set of psychophysical elements comes into existence somewhere quite distant from here. Probably, given the sorts of things I've been doing in this life, probably in one of the deepest hells. But nonetheless, these cause those over there. How does that happen without anything traveling from here to there? Answer, well, mental things can bring about changes at a distance. Don't need something physical making contact with something else physical to make something happen. Okay, but now, all of these schools, classical Abhidharma schools and Yogacara, accept consciousness as an ultimately real thing, but what exactly is Vijnana? Now, here I'm going to start bringing in some current terminology and some current theory from cognitive science and philosophy of mind. In CogSci, the distinction is drawn between creature consciousness and state consciousness. Creature consciousness is a property attributed to an organism by virtue of its representing its environment in such a way as to enable the organism to successfully engage with its environment. And so there are all sorts of things that have this interesting property of creature consciousness. You all do, I assume. I don't see any zombies here. And likewise, lots and lots of non-human animals seem to have it as well. But what is it that makes a creature be said to be conscious? Well, it's by virtue of its having conscious states. And what exactly is state consciousness? A mental state that the creature is aware of being in. In other words, there's something it's like for the creature to be in that state. And this, of course, is a red flag for many physicalists, because that there is something it's like is an invocation of there's something peculiar going on in here, the radically subjective realm, and a Buddhist is going to be a little worried about that. But the first worry that a Buddhist is going to raise about this definition, this account of what consciousness amounts to, is, well, there is no such thing as the creature that has these conscious states. Creature consciousness would make no sense ultimately. And one of the things we talked about yesterday afternoon was Buddhist mereological nihilism. A creature is a composite entity. It's a whole made of parts. And strictly speaking, there is no such thing as a whole made of parts. There is no chariot, no forest, no tree for that matter, no army, and likewise no person. Those are all examples in the suttas of things that are not, strictly speaking, real, mere conceptual fictions. The person is conventionally real, but not ultimately real. So you can talk about creature consciousness at the conventional level, but what we're interested in as Buddhists is what is reality itself like independently of the way in which we talk about it. And so, for any Buddhist, if there is such a thing as a state of consciousness, a conscious state, it has to be subjectless. There is no thing that is in that state. And that's going to be the first pass at getting around that problem of there's something it's like. But then, well, what exactly is it for a state, a dharma, to be a conscious state, a vijnana dharma? What is its intrinsic nature? Remember that once we've taken on board mereological nihilism, we are going to insist that the only ultimately real entities are things with intrinsic nature. They're svabhava. And they're the nature that they have in and of themselves, that they would have in the lonely state if there were nothing else existing. And that's the test for telling whether something is ultimately real. And so the question arises with respect to consciousness. If it is subjectless, what makes it be the sort of thing that it is independently of the existence of other things? Is there a nature common to all the states that we consider to be conscious states, states of consciousness, that is their essence? Now, the standard answer, not just among Buddhists, but among all classical Indian philosophers who believe that there is such a thing as consciousness, is illumination, prakasha. And the basic claim is consciousness illuminates its object just as the light of a lamp illuminates the items in a room. Turn the light on and, oh, well, you ignite the lamp. We're talking about an oil lamp. You ignite it and then you can see the things in the room. But is the property of illuminating an intrinsic property, something that an entity could have independently of the existence of anything else? And there's a problem, there are actually two problems here, I think. There's a problem of what I call the implicit accusative. Illumination is always the illuminating or making manifest of something else. So how can there be illumination? How can illumination be the intrinsic nature of something in a lonely state, in an unaccompanied state where nothing else exists? How is that possible? That's one problem. And there's also, and I think this is actually a deeper problem, the problem of the implicit dative. Consciousness as consciousness for something. Now think about illumination. Illumination makes something, makes the furniture in the room manifest. Manifest for whom? or someone, the observer, who we then can see the things in the room and not stumble over them. Can illuminating or representing or informing or manifesting be subjectless? And here I'm actually coming perilously close to sounding like a Nyayika, one of those Brahmanical philosophers who believes that there is a self, there is an Atma. It is the subject of consciousness. Because they claim the very idea of subjectless consciousness is, in fact, incoherent. It makes no sense. Okay? And those of my friends who are Nyayikas are actually very happy to hear me say things like this, to raise the problem of the implicit data. But I go on to crush their hopes that maybe I have, in fact, overcome my weird fascination with Buddhist philosophy. Now, Yogacara is going to try to solve both these problems by claiming that cognition is in fact a single entity, and it's only cognitive error that leads us to divide it up into these two distinct poles, the subject pole and the object pole. Okay, we'll be talking about that later. But before we get to that, I want to get to the general problem and the framework that's going to lead up to Yogacara. And this is the problem of metacognition. By metacognition, all I mean here is our ability to cognize our own cognitions. Okay? I see the pillar, and I am aware of my cognizing, my seeing, my being consciously aware of the pillar. Okay? I can cognize my own cognitions. We all have this capacity. We all do, adult human beings do. But, well, talk about all that later. Now, this question comes up because in the Buddhist tradition it's claimed quite widely that the moment of achieving enlightenment is marked by the ability to see that all the psychophysical elements, all the skandhas, are non-self and impermanent. It's that realization, directly cognizing each of the constituents of a person, that this is not self, okay? This finger is not self, and it's impermanent. Sooner or later, well, actually, I keep shedding cells from this finger because I've got very, very dry skin. In the winter, it gets really bad. And then my smartphone, which works by fingerprint ID, doesn't recognize me anymore, and I'm locked out of my phone. So it's all very exciting. So, obviously, this finger is impermanent, and it's not myself. I could exist without it, and even though my phone doesn't recognize me when it gets a little weird, it's obviously not myself. No question about that. So, what about other parts of the body? Sure, can do the same thing. What about my consciousness? I have to be able, according to this claim, I have to be able to cognize my own consciousness and recognize that it is not me and it is impermanent. Now, the impermanence part is easy because, you know, I go to sleep and then no more consciousness. But for that matter, you know, my thoughts drift from one thing to another, and a proper causal analysis of what's going on with cognition shows me that it's a new cognition from one moment to the next. One is caused by my sense of vision, another is caused by my sense of touch, or my sense of taste, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's easy, and I can directly cognize those things. But what about the cognition itself? How exactly am I going to pull this off of recognizing that it too is impermanent and non-self? Because cognition, if it is ultimately real, has to be momentary. And to directly cognize something would seem to require that it exist at the time of being cognized, okay? I feel the column, the pillar, it exists at the same time that I touch it and become aware of it, okay? So must the same thing not be true of cognition? And I don't cognize the cognitions of anyone else. This problem can come back and haunt us. And in a given mental stream, the stream that goes to make up what we think of as the mind of a person, there's only one cognition occurring at a time. Okay, you can't have two thoughts at exactly the same moment. You can't have two perceptions, two feelings at exactly the same moment. You can't be aware of them. So either an ultimately real cognition is directly cognized by itself, or else it's directly cognized by some distinct element occurring at that moment. That's the quandary, that this requirement for enlightenment, for liberation, of directly cognizing the impermanence and non-self nature of all the psychophysical constituents is met. Now, there are two different kinds of accounts of metacognition. One is parapakāsa, other illumination, or introspection, as we call it, looking within, perceiving by the force of the manas, the mind. The Vaibhashikas say that a cognition is cognized by simultaneously existing mental concomitants, at the chaita dharmas. Remember, there are four kinds of mental dharmas in classical skanda theory. There's vijnana, which is cognition, but then there's vedana, sanya, and the sanskaras. Okay, those three are feelings, affect, pleasure, pain, and indifference, samya, perceptual identifications, and sanskaras. Those are mental forces, like, for instance, intention, the intention to do something. Now, what the Vaibhashikas do to get around this problem is they say the chaita dharmas, those three, cognize cognition, vijnana, at the same time that the cognition cognizes them. So, each of them is cognized by a simultaneously existing cognition. Now, there are a couple of problems with this solution. Clearly, if chaita dharmas, and this is the standard account of chaita dharmas, they're merely accompaniments of cognition, they don't do the cognizing. It's always vijnana that does the cognizing. Then that's not going to work. If, on the other hand, and this is Sautrantika view, they rejected this distinction between chitta and chaita, even though the Buddha seems to have used that terminology, they say, well, these so-called chaita dharmas, those are just chit under different descriptions. So there's really just one kind of nama dharma in addition to rupa. So the five skandhas get collapsed into two in the Sautrantika ontology. Well, in that case, then it seems you're going to wind up with a self-illumination account. This is no longer an other illumination account. And that runs up against the problem of the principle of irreflexivity. An entity cannot perform its characteristic action on itself. Nothing is reflexive. Nothing ultimately real is reflexive in that manner. A fingertip can perform the action of touching something. It can touch the computer, it can touch the column, it can touch the nose. Can it touch itself? Well, try as I might, I can't quite do it. Now, there is something that might look like a way around the irreflexivity problem, which is mirror, fingertip. Oh, there's another fingertip. Oh, it's touching itself. Well, no, not really. In fact, a mirror image is a classical Buddhist example of an illusion, a cognitive error. Okay? And that's something that might be worth bearing in mind. So, okay, the fingertip can't cut itself, a knife can't cut itself, etc., etc. So, Sautrantika's wound up basically relaxing that simultaneity condition and turning to what's essentially an introspection account, according to which it's really the immediately succeeding moment at which a cognition is directly cognized. Okay? I see the pillar, and a moment, an instant later, even though that cognition has ceased, I am aware of cognizing the pillar. How can I do that? How can I be aware of something no longer exists? Obviously through memory, through short-term memory. Okay? That's what the Sautrantikas wind up saying. I know that in Tibetan tradition, Sautrantikas are often portrayed as going the Svasamvedana route, the reflexive awareness, cognition, cognizing itself, but there is some evidence that this is what classical Indian Sautrantikas said. Now, in addition to the Padaprakash view, there's the Svaprakash view, and that's the one that, of course, is justly famous. Every cognition is self-cognizing, cognizing both its object and itself. This is the official view of Yogacara. Now, this clearly looks like a violation of the principle of irreflexivity. How can a cognition cognize itself any more than fingertip can't touch itself, a knife can't cut itself, even the most skilled acrobat cannot stand on their own shoulders? How is this possible? Well, the response is the example of light that illuminates both itself and the object in the room. But there are a couple of problems with this counterexample. On the first, that word light, dīpa, is ambiguous. Are we talking now about the lamp, the thing that emits the light, the oil lamp with the wick and the oil? Or are we talking about the light that is emitted by the flame when the lamp is lit? A lamp, the physical object, the oil lamp, can exist without illuminating. So illuminating cannot be its intrinsic nature. Now, what about the light? Well, something can be said to be illuminated only if it can also exist in the unilluminated state, and light cannot exist in the dark. Okay? This is Nagarjuna's point in Vigaha-Vyavardhini. Long before Dignaga and Dharmakirti invoked the example of the light that illuminates itself, he pointed out there's a problem with that. But there's another problem as well with the Svaprakash, Svasamvedana doctrine of Yogacara, because what it winds up doing is coming up with two distinct accounts, two distinct concepts of consciousness or cognition. Because on the Yogacara view, each of us is immediately directly aware of our own cognition. That's what Svaprakash means. It's whenever there is a cognition occurring in this person stream, there is awareness of that cognition because that very cognition cognizes itself. Okay? And so I don't need to look for evidence of the occurrence of cognition. It's just immediately apparent, okay? So there's no criteria of application of the concept consciousness in the first person case. It's just obvious. I don't need to look for, gather evidence. In the case of third person attribution of consciousness, on the other hand, I do need evidence. I need to see someone perform an action or utter a report, say something. Those are both evidence for my coming to be aware that this creature is conscious. Now, what that means is we're really looking at two distinct concepts. One that we apply to ourselves, the other that we apply to others. But if they are distinct concepts, when I say that you are all conscious, I don't mean the same thing as when I am aware of myself as being conscious. And that's a problem. That looks like solipsism, the view that there really is just one consciousness in reality, namely this one. Now, people sometimes try to get around this problem by saying that when we attribute consciousness to others, we do so by analogy with the first person case. But analogies don't really cut it. You're really saying something else about someone else. So we're left with the problem of solipsism. Nonetheless, Dignaga forges ahead. He doesn't see this. It's not until Ratnakirti that the problem of solipsism in Yogacara is explicitly thematized. Dharmakirti actually has a response to the alleged problem of solipsism. He says, of course, there's no problem with the existence of other minds, even though we don't believe there are other bodies. We do believe, and consequently can never be directly aware of the existence of other persons, because we can't cognize cognitions going on in another mental stream. Nonetheless, we can readily show that there are, in fact, other minds. Ratnakirti comes back with a very lengthy and very interesting response that basically says, well, yeah, we Yogacarans are stuck with the problem of solipsism. There really is just one consciousness at any given moment. Now, Dignaga gives the following argument against this introspectionist view of Sautrantika. Remember, the Sautrantika view, which is a Padaprakasha, an other illumination view, says, well, it's immediately after a cognition occurs that you can introspectively be aware of that cognition. Now, that involves memory. The cognition that I am cognizing right now, the cognition of feeling the pillar, no longer exists when I become aware of it. So how am I aware of something that no longer exists? Answer, it must be through memory. And that's the source of the problem, because I only remember experiences that I actually have. One only remembers, you might seem to remember all sorts of things, but when we actually run the data on your biography, we discover, no, you were never there at that time, the place that you claim you remember being in. So it's a false memory, it's not a real memory. Okay? You only remember experiences that you actually had. Or maybe you were there, but you were asleep, you were unconscious, okay? Then even though you claim, you report, yeah, I remember being there, once again, it's a false memory, deluded. But to remember an experience is to recall not just the content of the experience, but also the cognizing of that content. This is the difference between cognizing something and remembering the cognition. To remember the cognition is to be aware of its content, but also be aware of its being something that one experienced. Now, for some content that occurred at T sub 1, that's the time when the experience happened, to be remembered at some later time, T sub n, the content must have been experienced at some earlier time. Right? I mean, that's, you only remember what you did in fact experience. And let's suppose, for reductio, that cognition does not cognize itself. What we're going to do is reduce to absurdity the alternative, the Padaprakash, other illumination view, which on the best version, the Sautrantika version, requires memory. Suppose cognition does not cognize itself. Then the remembering at T sub n of the experience at T sub 1 requires that there have occurred a cognizing of C, that original cognition, of some cognition that occurred later than T sub 1, but earlier than T sub n, say at T sub n minus 1, a moment earlier than the time that I say I remember this experience. But this cognition is likewise later than the experiencing at T sub 1, so it likewise involves the use of memory. And you only remember what you actually experienced, and if you didn't in fact experience the occurrence of the cognition at T sub 1, then it must have been at some yet earlier moment than Tn minus 1, namely Tn minus 2, or maybe even earlier, and then you've got an infinite regress going. An infinite regress results, Dignaga claims, from supposing that you cognize your own cognitions through remembering the occurrence of a cognition. Because you only remember what you actually experienced. So if you didn't actually experience the occurrence of the cognition at the time that you were aware of the pillar, then you would not be able to remember it. Because you would require infinitely many cognitions between the time T sub n, when you say, oh, I remember cognizing the pillar, and the time when you actually cognize the pillar. And that's not going to work. So that's Dignaga's argument. And the only way around this is by conceding that at the time of cognizing the pillar, that cognition that cognized the pillar was aware of itself, was reflexively self-aware. Okay? That's the argument. So, Padaprakash goes down in flames. Only svasamvedana, only self-illumination makes sense. Now, Dignaga has a response also to the irreflexivity objection. He says, look, every cognition has two forms. The form of the subject, I'm going to call it S, which is its being a cognition, something that cognizes, something that makes manifest, something that brings, that illuminates, okay? That's what it means to call something a cognition. But at the same time, Dignaga is here bringing on board the representationalist view of cognition that Sautrantika first developed. A cognition has the form of its object. So in the case of my touching the pillar, okay, the cognition on this account is something that illuminates, something that makes manifest, but it also has the form of the cold, hard pillar as part of the content of that cognition. The cognition has these two distinct forms. I'm calling them S and O. S stands for subject, O for object. It has the form of the object, okay? It's a representation in here of what's out there. Well, of course, for Dignaga, there is nothing out there. It's just a karmic seed that, in fact, makes manifest, blah, blah, blah. So, two forms. But cognitions are supposed to be dharmas. They're supposed to be ultimately real. And a dharma cannot be a mereological sum. Something that has two distinct forms is a mereological sum. Remember from yesterday what happened to the atom, understood as something that is both round and colorless. Okay? Those two different forms of the atom are analytically separable, and hence the atom, understood in that way, is a mereological sum. It's a composite entity. What we have to do is break down everything that shows any signs of complexity, of being composite. And so, if a cognition has two forms, that means it's not ultimately real. So, Dignago, what are you doing? Answer, the distinction between O and S is just the result of our anadi avidya, our beginningless ignorance. And what is it ignorance of? That the subject-object dichotomy is in fact a superimposition, that we superimpose on reality when in fact there is no distinction to be drawn between the grahya, what is grasped, the O, and the grahaka, the grasper, the S. That distinction that we all draw is in fact illusory. That's, we superimpose it because, well, we always have beginningless. It's always, this is the primal sin, original sin. Now, if we accept the claim that this distinction is in fact illusory, that it's a false superimposition, it's ignorance, then we wind up having to say that cognitions, which in Dignaga's world are the only ultimately real entities, are inexpressible, anabhilapya. They cannot be described because try to articulate what something is like without objectifying it, without saying something about it. You can't do that. So, ultimate nature of reality, it turns out, is inexpressible, it's ineffable. And Dignaga is perfectly happy saying that. And Dharmakirti says something similar. There is, for a philosopher, a little problem with that. Actually, Bhavyaveka points this out, that when you say reality is indescribable, ineffable, you run up against this paradox. If it's ineffable, how can you say that? If it's inexpressible, indescribable, aren't you in fact effing it? Aren't you describing it? So, that's a problem. Now, we looked at Dignaga's memory argument for svasambhidna, for reflexivity, the self-cognizing nature of all cognitions. Let's look briefly at another argument. Dharmakirti actually follows Dignaga in giving the memory argument. It gives a slightly strange version of it, but it's there nonetheless. But he gives an independent argument in Pramana Vinishtya, and it goes like this. It's the anabhilapya, the sopalambaniyama, the fixed rule argument, I sometimes call it. Now, remember these two aspects of a given cognition, the subject aspect, the object aspect. Those are the two aspects that Dignaga said are just the result of ignorance. There's really just one thing. But we always cognize them together, okay? What is a cognition? What is its nature? All about the cognizing of its object, okay? But we also always cognize O together with S. So the cognizing of O is not distinct from the cognizing of S. Premise one gives us the identity of S and O, so when we cognize O, we're also cognizing S. They're one and the same thing. So you can't cognize one without cognizing the other. So you cognize O only if you cognize S. Now, here he takes a step back into the ordinary world and says, look, if you're trying to get an object, you're not going to see an artha, an A, and your aim is to get something like, okay, my favorite example for some strange reason, blueberry ice cream, because Indian philosophers always use the color blue when they're giving nice stock examples of perception, seeing blue. So, okay, seeing blue, well, seeing blueberry ice cream. You only seek to obtain blueberry ice cream if you're aware of it. But in order to be aware of blue, you have to be aware of the cognizing of blue. And that's by three, which we proved from one and two. Now, suppose that the cognition of A occurs only after cognition of A. That's what the opponent, who is an other illumination theorist, who thinks cognition of cognition works through introspection a moment later, that's what they claim. Suppose they were right. But you don't cognize A unless you cognize S. And so you get an infinite regress that results from that supposition. You're going to have to cognize the cognizing of S in order to cognize you see how it goes. So if cognition does not cognize itself, there will be no acting to obtain one's goals, and all would go to hell in a handbasket. That's my free translation of Asangatam Vishvam Syat. Now, let's think about that argument. I wouldn't get what I want unless I were aware not only of the object that I want, but also of the cognizing of the object that I want. And if that had to happen in a subsequent cognition, then we'd be in deep doo-doo. Suppose we accept the identity of S and O, which is what the Yogacharans insist. Well, then that second and third premises follow. But now, four is only true if we understand being aware of A, of the artha, the object that I'm after, my blueberry ice cream, as meaning cognition of A under a concept that links its occurrence to the attainment of some goal. I have to be aware of the blue as blue ice cream, and I love ice cream, so blah, blah, blah. It has to be what concepts do for us in general? Okay. What concepts do for us in general is they allow us to bring past experience of success and failure into our actions in the world under current circumstances. Because I cognize something blue, my past experience with blue things has sometimes led to my getting my favorite kind of ice cream. So I have to be able to retrieve that concept and use it. Now, here's the problem. In three, we're using the word cognize in the following way. One cognizes O only if one cognizes S. Does it require that one cognize S under the concept of S? And here, this is actually a Himalayan version of Frege's argument for the sense reference distinction, the Hesperus phosphorus example. We got these two names for Mount Everest, the Nepali name Sagarmatha and the Chinese name Jumalongba. Now, when I see Sagarmatha, I see Jumalongba because they're one and the same mountain, Mount Everest, we call it. But when I see Everest from Nepal and call it Sagarmatha, do I know it to be Ujjumilanma? Only if I have this additional information, not necessarily. So the regress that Dharmakirti claims you run into when you suppose that you don't cognize S when you cognize O, it's not generated because of basically the sense reference distinction. Okay, so I'm sorry, I ran through that argument and the difficulties of that argument fairly quickly. We can talk about that later, or I can put it all back up on the screen if necessary. But I want to get through a couple of other points before I conclude. Now, let's go back to the memory argument Dignaga gave. It might actually work against the Sautrantika introspectionist view. And I think there are actually independent reasons to suppose that that's true. But there are alternative introspection accounts. Well, none of those are really implausible, are in fact plausible. For instance, how could there be two cognizings in a single moment? That's kind of hard to follow. And that seems to lead to mutual reciprocal dependence. That's always a problem. So that might give us a reason to reject any so-called higher order perception account of metacognition, according to which one perceives internally through introspection as opposed to exterior perception, one perceives one's own cognitions. But there are alternative higher order thought accounts. And in particular, there's Kumarala's Artapati account of how metacognition works. And what he's basically saying is this: when we attribute cognition to someone, what we're doing is performing an abductive inference, an Artapati, an inference to the best explanation. Here is some evidence, the best explanation for that evidence being how things are is blah, blah, blah. We are, in other words, attributing a property based on a theory about how the world works. The claim in Kumarala's case is we are attributing consciousness in accordance with a theory of mind. Okay, what happens is this. I become aware of the object as having the property of objectness, vishyata, or vishyatva, can't remember which. And how do I become aware of the pillar as having this property of objecthood or objectness? Answer, I just spoke about the pillar. My speech is evidence that I'm aware of the pillar. Or the other possibility is I act, okay? I can tell because when I want to get over to the window, I walk around it, that I see the pillar, that I cognize the pillar, okay? Those two kinds of evidence are evidence that there was cognition of the pillar. Now, that seems like a long and very roundabout way of making sense of our attributions of consciousness. Maybe it works in the third person case. Maybe that's why I believe that you all are conscious, because I see you, I make some outrageous claim and you kind of frown. So that's an action, and I attribute consciousness of what I just said to your santana, your causal series, because, well, that's evidence that there is something going on inside. There is consciousness. But is this also true of ourselves? Is this also true of the first person case? Now, Kumarala says, look, the only way we can be aware of cognition is precisely through this kind of abductive influence. And this holds in the first person case as well as in the third person case. Chaitra's cognition cannot be the object of another of Chaitra's cognitions. We cannot directly introspect our own cognitions. Why not? Because it's a cognition like that of another person. I'm not aware of your cognition. I only know of your cognition through this kind of evidence that you behave in a certain way or you say something. Okay, speech or behavior. But why should I be any different? Because cognitions are not things that, what Kumarala is doing here is getting around the problem of solipsism. If I'm attributing to you the same property I attribute to myself, it must be on the basis of the same kind of evidence. The concept has to be the same in both cases. In which case, my cognition of my own cognition is arrived at in exactly the same way. I see myself either saying, oh, there's a pillar here, or behaving in a certain way, walking around it. And from that evidence, I gather, there must have been cognition of the pillar. Consciousness is something we posit. It's a theoretical posit, a dark matter of the astrophysicists. They explain facts about what we, in fact, observe. So, this is an option when it comes to accounting for metacognition. Dignaga's argument from memory did not refute this. Consequently, the difficulties of Dignaga's argument, solipsism, the ineffability problem, violation of irreflexivity, make it the less attractive account of how we cognize our own cognitions. So, perhaps consciousness is not ultimately real and just a useful fiction. Okay? And that might conceivably open the door to a Buddhist physicalism. This afternoon, what I'm going to do is I present some evidence for the sort of account I think a Buddhist physicalist could adopt of what exactly is going on, following up on Kumarala's abductive inference account, which actually was adopted by certain Buddhists, namely in Prajnakaramati's commentary on Shantideva's Bodhicaryavatara, chapter 9, there's a lengthy discussion of just this sort of account. And now, unlike Kumarala, and Shantideva and Prajnakaramati are not Atmavadins. They don't believe in the self. Okay? Now, they're Majjhimikas, which means they don't believe in anything. But, nonetheless, they do seem to see this as a genuine option as a response to the Yogacara self-reflexivity account. So that's what I'm going to take advantage of this afternoon. And I'm going to have some other things to say, bringing in more material from contemporary cognitive science to try to motivate this alternative account. Okay, so I am done, I think. I think that's the last slide. Yeah.
It's the last slide. Great.
Okay,
wonderful. Thank you. Good timing. And so that leaves us with about half an hour for discussion. Yes, please, George.
Thank you for a wonderful management presentation. I have this idea about irreflexivity. So we are talking about the fingertip touching itself. But what if we change like kind of language and say fingertip becomes aware of itself, and when, like, let's imagine that the finger is kind of damaged, and when it touches something, it is aware of its object, but at the same time, it is aware of its own condition, like of itself. And like, so when I touch my computer, I'm aware of kind of my skin as well at the same time, and
first of all, I have trouble with the idea of a fingertip being aware of anything. A fingertip is a sense organ. Sense organs, when they come in contact with an appropriate object, are said to cause cognition. It's the cause of the cognition. It's a part of the anecdotal cause and conditions of the arising of the cognition. So, now it is true. I mean, okay, I want to be charitable to your example. When my fingertip is damaged, as it is right now, because, you know, I have to wash my hands and dries them out even more and more and more skin flakes off and blah, blah, blah. And I can be aware of that fact about my fingertip from performing the operation of touching something. Now, okay, is that, I mean, even if the fingertip were the thing that was aware, would it be aware simultaneously of the touching the computer, and the damaged state of the fingertip itself? That sounds to me like two distinct cognitions. The second one is mediated by the information I have about how my fingertip normally functions. And so it involves an inference. Okay, I've got this awareness of the smooth surface of the computer, but it's not quite the same as what I expected. There is a prediction error in my I'm using a predictive processing model of cognition. There's a prediction error that leads to the inference that there's some damage. Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like fame, like it has fame, right? So, and then like the Ra, if we are speaking in terms of physiology, the Ra is one nerve, say an impulse thing, like the reason. Damage means pain, but we don't, like at the level of subject, we feel pain, and then we consider, okay, that's something wrong with the finger, because usually we don't have pain. But at the same time, the moment we feel like coolness of metal, it is kind of happens simultaneously with pain going via another route.
See, I know it all happens very, very quickly, so that it can seem to be simultaneous. But the Buddhist always returns this image of the whirling firebrand. You take a torch that's lit, and you whirl it around fast enough, and what you see is a circle of fire. There is no circle of fire. There is just the flame at this point, and the flame at that point, and the flame at that point, but it happens so rapidly, it looks to be one single image. Because we can't process at the level of momentariness. Because everything arises, and then just poof, it's gone. But something else is there. And in the case of the whirling firebrand, where it is a little further around than the first one we saw, the one from a moment before. So this sense that we might have when we think about the example of the painful touching of the computer may well be a matter of two distinct cognitions that happen immediately in succession. And so it's easy to and take those to be, in fact, simultaneous, when in fact, they may not be.
Could you go back a slide, the slide before this one?
Just the one before?
Yeah. So I was thinking about the abductive inference account. In the final bullet point, it says that you can make inferences based on thinking blue, but then I was a bit confused because isn't that inference a cognitive sentiment? Because I understand if you say blue or you reach for blueberry ice cream, then you can make an inference based on that behavior. But if you think blue, isn't that still metacognitionism based on behavior? It's on thought, and you can't necessarily do that from the person perspective because you can't base inference on other people's thoughts.
I'm not quite sure I've got exactly what your question is, but let me just run through this one more time, perhaps in slightly different terms. Okay, what Kumarla is claiming is that you don't need to suppose that every cognition cognizes itself. You can instead suppose that when we attribute cognition to anyone, including ourselves, we do it from evidence. And the evidence has to do with either behavior or speech. I say that there is a pillar. That's evidence that I'm aware of the pillar. I walk around the pillar. That's evidence that I'm aware of the pillar. Just like if you say, oh yeah, there are eight pillars. Yeah, there are eight pillars in the room. That's evidence that you are aware of the pillars. And if you start weaving around all the pillars, likewise evidence, okay, that you have creature consciousness. It sounds odd to us to say that we do it in the same way for ourselves as we do it for other people. But in fact, okay, what Kumarla actually says, and to motivate the claim about Chaitra, Chaitra cannot cognize Chaitra's own cognitions because they're cognitions, just like someone else's cognitions. What he actually says to motivate that is actions are things that occur over time. And you can't directly cognize a change occurring over time. The example that Mimatsukas always use is the example of seeing the sun overhead and then seeing it on the western horizon. Okay? What do we say? The sun moved. But do we actually see the sun moving? No. It's too slow. What we see is first the sun here and then the sun over there. And we infer the best explanation of first seeing the sun here and then seeing the sun there is the sun performed the action of moving. And the same is true of cognition in Kumarla's account. It's likewise an action. And actions are not directly perceived. So that's his account, but in fact, you don't have to agree with him about cognition being an action. Given all the difficulties with Dignaga's account and Dharmakirti's account, why not accept this particular view? Now, I'm actually going to be presenting more evidence for this sort of view from modern cog sci this afternoon. But I think it's a very interesting and plausible account that answers all sorts of difficulties that arise when Buddhists try to grapple with this problem. What exactly is cognition? So I'm not sure if that's really...
I think the question was that in the final line, of course, you know, okay, it's inferred from speech and action, and you have saying, which is an action, and reaching, which is an action, but thinking, of course, is only my own action, right? So it's not that I could infer anybody else.
Was that
the point?
Yes, that's
right. Okay. Yeah. And that I will, in fact, talk about this afternoon. But thought is an action. And the sort of, what it in fact is a kind of speech act. is an internal speech act. You think to yourself, oh, there's a pillar here. Oh, blue ice cream. Hey, go for it. That's an action. And that's evidence that I must have been aware of.
Thanks. Yes, because you and then Jake. Can you speak up a little bit?
Oh, it's particularly in mind what you just said, thought is a speech action. I was wondering, why do you assume that self-awareness or self-metacognition would be the same kind of thing as cognition of an object? When you said, my experience of myself from my experience, my understanding of my experience is a different quality than the objects that I perceive. The kind of cognition, the inner cognition that I do about my experience is a different kind of thing. So it might be that they're both happening simultaneously, but they're not the same, they wouldn't inhabit the same kind of drama position. Or I guess I just wonder, why do we assume that self-awareness and cognition of objects are the same? Or are you open?
Why assume that cognition and cognition of objects are the same sort of thing? Well, that was required by this account of what enlightenment is all about. You have to be able to be aware of each and every element of the psychophysical complex as impermanent and non-self. And that means what goes for my hand must likewise go for my cognition, if cognition is one of the ultimate psychophysical constituents.
Is that realization the same kind of cognition as,
I wonder, in the moment of enlightenment, is that just another cognition, as I say, my fingers and my fingers and myself?
Is it a different kind of cognition?
See, that sort of
sounds
question.
Okay.
I mean, sure, that's what Dignan Ramakirti would want to say. That in fact, they don't actually want to say that, because what they want to say is that cognition and object are actually non-distinct. There is no distinction to be drawn. And so, what goes for the object must also go for the subject's object. So they would agree that it has to be the same sort of operation in both cases. They have.
I mean, you could say that they're not distinct, but that they're not identical, right?
But they don't want to say that the S and O, the Svadgara and the Atakara are identical. They want to say instead that it's simply wrong to make that distinction. But I mean, Dharmakirti's argument does in fact turn on their identity. And okay, with Dignaga, it's not so clear, the memory argument, whether the best that I've ever been able to make of the kind of view of cognition that falls out of Dignaga's argument is by way of Sartre's account of, in the transcendence of the ego, cognitions being reflexive. Galen Strawson does something similar in more recent times, but I think Sartre's account is quite clear. The awareness of the S side of a cognition, according to Sartre, is non-thematized. It's not explicit. But it is there, it has to be there. And why does it have to be there? Well, basically, for the sort of reason that Dignaga and Dharmakirti have in mind. But there's still this difficulty that, well, first of all, there's the irreflexivity problem. And second, there is this alternative account. It does not have that problem. this abductive inference account of attributions of cognition. So, sure, you can try and sort of weave and bob and get around all of those, but this looks to be a better theory. That's what the Buddhist physicalists would say.
Thank you very much for this really fascinating stuff. I can't remember, but I think Chandrakirti's explanation of memory is quite relevant here. And it seems, I don't know if you can remember it. I'm breaking my brain. What you're saying here at the moment, it sounds quite close to this appeal to basically common convention, and thus that's how we have memory without any need for sort of data not existing ultimately. Arguably the same convention. I swear I was putting the spot there. That's like
in the Bhashya, right. Well, you should be knowing this better than I do.
I can look it up and look for next time. Yeah, but it seems to really connect to this explanation quite closely.
I'm just zoning out, but I'm not recalling what Chandrika says about memory that's relevant directly to this. I mean, I remember him saying in response to, is it the Jain Pulapaksha or is it the Charvaka? That memory is not the source, it's not Pramana.
Yeah, it's in the context of refuting Yogacara, the need for Swasambhira. There's some kind of recall to worldly conventions that if you see an object, if you see someone, next time you see them again or you remember them again, there was cognition. The subjective cognition doesn't need to have copies itself at the moment of the original experience through recourse to some kind of worldly convention, but yeah.
Right, okay, so I think there was another question. Yeah.
Thanks very much. That's really lovely. I have two questions. The first one is about the slide before this one. That's the 11th slide, assessing the argument. The one before this one. I think I heard you say that the sense reference distinction allows one to defeat the regressus ad infinitum. Did not uses, and I was hoping you could. I don't understand that. If you could explain that again to me.
Okay, what Dharmakirti is trying to do is show that we would not act on cognition, so everything would go to hell in a handbasket, if we did not. We were not aware simultaneously of the object form and the subject form, the svakara and the arthakara. Because they are in fact identical according to, well, if consciousness is ultimately real, they must be identical because if consciousness is ultimately real, it can only have one intrinsic nature. It cannot be a composite made of these two distinct aspects. And so it must be ignorance of the fact that the subject-object dichotomy is in fact a false superimposition that leads us to draw that distinction. So they are identical, and when we cognize the one, we also cognize the other. Consequently, since we would not in fact act on a cognition in which we were not aware of the object form, but being aware of the object form means being aware of the subject form, we must be simultaneously aware of the subject form. And that's svasambhira, that's reflexive self-cognition, reflexive metacognition. The difficulty, I think, with that argument is it fails to see the the application, how the sense reference distinction applies in this particular case. Because he says, look, we wouldn't act on cognition of blue unless we were aware of what I'm cognizing as blue. I wouldn't go for that blue thing I see unless I were aware of it as blue, and so hooking up with my fondness for blueberry ice cream. But consequently, I must simultaneously, because S and O are identical, be aware of the S side. But that's ignoring the sense reference distinction, because the connection between awareness of blue and action is by way of the concept of blue hooking up with my conception of blueberry ice cream. And I don't need to be aware of the S side of that one thing that is simultaneously both S and O in order for me to act on awareness of blue. Do you see that?
Can you say that last one?
I don't need to, I mean, I need to recognize, oh yeah, blue. I don't need to recognize, oh yes, cognition of blue. I don't need that in order to be spurred to act on my awareness of blue. It's only under the concept blue that action is triggered by that cognition. It's not under the concept cognition of blue that action is triggered. Even though it's, according to Dharmakirti, one thing, a cognition that is simultaneously, erroneously thought of as both S and O, the only part that's relevant to my action is the O side. And that's where the sense reference distinction comes in. I can be aware of this mountain under one concept, and since it is equally referred to by this other name, I am aware of it under that other name, under that other description, but I'm not aware of being aware of it under that description. There's a difference.
I mean, what about non-conceptual cognition? So it seems like you're coming to the level of a conceptual, right? Distinguish between a conceptual cognition and a non-conceptual cognition. So the subject-object identity is there, even if you have no conception of the object that's put it off. In which case, this idea of the sense reference distinction is not even
yet. The sense reference distinction comes into play precisely because it is moved to action. I don't get the art, my aim, my goal, unless I'm aware of it under this description. Mm-hmm. I have to be aware of it under the concept of blue, because otherwise, you know, it's some colored object, big deal. Lots of them are.
That's also constructed in
But you can't just simply assume that cognition's cognizant and stuff to be evidence. What he's presenting here is what he thinks of as independent evidence for possibility. And the evidence goes by way of, I mean, he says at the end, we don't go to hell in handbells. Unless we were aware simultaneously of the O and the S. But how does he get it? We have to be aware of yes by way of this link to action. Okay. And the news comes by way of the description.
Okay. Great, I think we have time for one more question, Jacob.
Yes, thank you for the talk. This connects with a couple of the previous questions about whether the cognition of S is the same thing. to be an external object, which as whole would be conceptual, I think.
Yeah, see, I mean, if I'm a convinced yoga charm, I'm going to deny that there is such a thing as Buddha asking, but nonetheless, I can get satisfaction from my desire through acting on this perception I now have of Buddha. Without, I mean, the action comes by way of conceptualization. I have to think of this as a cognition of Buddha. But the cognition, the O side is just the Buddha, which is, that's the arcana of this, that's the arcana of this cognition.
Right.
So we are one thing in cognition that we erroneously think of as having these two aspects, the S side, the cognizing side, the manifesting, the prakasha side,
right,
and the object side, the arcana.
But the way that we are aware of O is very different from the way that we are aware of S. Because
well, yeah,
the way that
we,
S is just...
if we follow Ansatva, then we'd say our awareness of O is thematized, our awareness is non-thematized, but it is nonetheless implicit too.
Right.
And in fact, since it's really just one thing, it's just a matter of habitually acting on the basis of the content, the O side of the human cognition, that leads us to focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I suppose my, yes, what I was thinking is that in order to think about S, in order to think about subjects, it also relies on evidence. In Dhammakitti, in the Proof of Other Minds, talks about inferring one's own intentions. And Vasubandhu may not have the same model, but talks about that our awareness of our own minds is just as uncertain as our awareness of other minds. So it seems like we can have direct cognition of our own mind, but it wouldn't be conceptual, it wouldn't be saying, it wouldn't be taking it to be one's own mind, it wouldn't be as logical. And so our ordinary kind of way of treating our own minds and other minds are not disanalogous, both are conceptually mediated and rely on evidence.
Well, insofar as we're describing a particular stream of cognitions as a mind, we are clearly conceptualizing. The question, though, is in order to do that, must we not be able to cognize individual cognitions?
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be direct on this mind. That has to be perception on the mind.
Right.
Or on perceptual judgment. What Dharmakirti's argument, like the Ignatius memory argument, is meant to do is show that, in fact, we are directly aware of both simultaneously. And it's just an error that makes us draw that distinction. But I'm saying Dharmakirti's argument fails, and Ignatius' argument, I'm well sure on that model, the alternative introspection is to have a high order perception, not what we're. But there is this alternative higher order thought that like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets around all those different things. That's all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We now have a lunch break until 2 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, we'll have the final installment, right? Where all of the objections will be answered and then will be revealed. So I look forward to you all coming back. Thank you very much.
I'm looking forward to your